Still, he caught her in his strong arms, holding her close. And then he did what would have seemed impossible a mere fortnight ago. He allowed her to lift his black mask, revealing those beautiful dark eyes she'd stared at for days on end, while wondering what the rest of him looked like. She pulled down the mesh shield that blocked the lower half of his face, the face which, despite its ghostly pallor and black, bulging veins, no longer seemed so foreign to her. No, she had memorized the lines of his strong jaw, the shape of his masculine nose, the feel of his thick brows. The taste of his lips, which she tasted again now, pressing her mouth against them so hard she could barely breathe. In this moment, he was her breath. He was the beat of her heart and the blood in her veins. He was her knight in black armor, the only one who seemed to truly understand her. And when their lips separated, it was too soon, was always too soon. And Anise felt as if a part of her had been removed, like a severed limb. How is this possible? She'd wondered to herself on numerous occasions. How is he possible? He was her best friend from childhood. A boy who she'd been told was dead from a horrible bone disease, now reborn as a man. Though Taryn Sheery considered the witch's dark magic that had saved his life a curse, the source of his unusual appearance, superhuman size and strength, Anise would only ever think of it as a blessing, a second chance.
"You know, Sir Dietrich might never be able to have children because of your boot," he said.
She could feel the rumble of his voice as it rose from his chest, which was pressed tightly against hers. "Pity," she said, cupping his cheek in her palm.
"He saved your life. Perhaps he deserves a little patience."
"I appreciate what he did, and have thanked him for his courage numerous times. But until he tells the truth, I will not see him."
A look of amusement crossed Taryn's broad face.
"I think I've come up with your royal nickname," he said.
Anise didn't think she was going to like it, but she said,
"Go on."
"The Stubborn Queen."
She tried to hit him, but he grabbed her hand and held it back, and then kissed her again, softer this time, exploring her lips, her tongue. She explored back. This time, when they broke apart, his eyes bore into hers, and she detected a question in that look.
"What?"
she asked.
"How?"
he said.
"How what?"
"Just how," he repeated.
She thought she understood what he meant.
"I've asked myself the same question a million times. Remember, I'm not the one who returned from the dead."
"To me, you did."
His voice had grown gravelier, more serious, sending electricity to every part of her.
"Why, Taryn," she said, "I would never have taken you for a romantic."
His eyes never leaving hers, he carried her backwards, setting her on the edge of her cot, his giant hands roaming down her sides and around her hips. He kissed her once more, quick, stabbing kisses, broken up by words.
"The reason,"
kiss,
"Sir Dietrich,"
kiss,
"came to see," kiss, "you."
"Stop talking,"
she said, clutching the back of his helmet, ripping it off, pulling him closer.
"Keep kissing."
He did, and for the next few minutes they fought the urge to do more, an urge they'd been fighting for the last fortnight due to the lack of privacy that came with staying in a busy tavern. Oh, and the fact that her brother was sleeping in the bed next to them and could awaken at any moment.
"There's someone to see you,"
Taryn finally managed to get out. He was breathing heavily, and so was Anise.
"Lady Zelda,"
Anise said, gulping down air.
"No, a stranger. An unusual fellow. Calls himself Sir Christoph Metz."
Anise frowned.
"And why should I talk to this Sir Metz fellow?"
"He claims he has information on your uncle's army,"
Taryn said. 6. The Southern Empire, Fanes. Jai Jaru. When they finally reached the mine, the sun had long since fallen below the horizon. The temperature had dropped by half, the cold infused in each gust of wind, which sent shivers up Jai's spine. He stepped from the chariot and said, You can stay here for the night. You will be given bed and nourishment.
Yes, master,
the slave said. This man wasn't a Garadia slave, or Jai might have acted very differently. He belonged to the Emperor's palace, and thus Jai couldn't risk treating him the way he longed to, like a person. He left the man to tend to the horses, striding toward the entrance to the mine, which was as dark and foreboding as a red pison's maw. Above the opening stood a towering rock, but the outcropping itself held little value. No, it was what was beneath the ground that mattered. The diamonds. Though many of the Emperor's mines contained an abundance of beautiful jewels, it was the diamonds that Hoser craved the most. They were like an addiction to him, and he was rumored to have entire pools filled with them, in which he would bathe, running the gems over every inch of his body, letting their sharp edges cut his skin. Which was exactly why every master wanted to be Jai Giroo, master of Garadia. Controlling Garadia meant you always had the Emperor's ear, so long as you were producing up to his standards. Which Jai was, giving him plenty of leeway as to the treatment of his slaves. He entered the mine, pausing just inside the threshold to allow his eyes to adjust to the flickering orangey darkness. Torches were lit along the tunnel, which almost immediately branched off in three different directions. One went toward the master's quarters, one toward the shafts leading below to the mines, and one toward the slaves' quarters. After a long, hard ride, any other master would have gone straight to the lavish quarters they'd been provided with. Jai had a plush, feathered mattress he'd never slept on, a large golden tub he'd never filled with warm water, a broad hearth he'd never lit, and a full larder of foodstuffs he'd never eaten. He allowed his mine masters to use all of his amenities in exchange for their cooperation and silence. Instead, Jai headed to the left toward the slaves' quarters, where he slept, bathed, and broke bread with his workers. His people. He paused only momentarily to use a small washbasin to clean the white powder from his face. While in the city, he was forced to wear it, but never in Garadia, not amongst his people. Many of the workers were already asleep when he entered the broad cavern where they lived, when they weren't toiling in the mines. That was typical. The back-breaking work they did wore on a person, no matter how young or old, how thin or broad, how strong or weak. Slowly, over days or weeks or months or sometimes years, they were broken until they had nothing left to give. Garadia had the lowest death rate of any of the mines, and yet Jai lost at least one soul each and every day, either from accident or fatigue. Some were replaced by new slaves. Some were not. Like the slaves in the capital city of Fainia, Garadia was primarily made up of Terrans, though he also had about 24 dreadnoughters. The grey-skinned people tended to be taller and broader than the other workers, their hands and feet half again as large. The islanders spoke infrequently, and when they did, their voices seemed to rumble up from their bellies. He spotted one of them sleeping off to the side, both his eyes open. Though Jai knew the sleeping giant couldn't see him, it still creeped him out the way the dreadnoughters slept with their eyes open. Jai blinked and moved on. The cavern smelled of stale bread and sweat and damp earth. Thousands of workers occupied the cavern at this time of day, most of them sleeping side by side or milling about the washing area, a natural underground stream, or breaking bread in small circles. Several of the workers who were still awake noticed his entrance and offered him a welcome, three fingers in the air, one for the master, one for the slave, and one for what they'd become, something other. It was a sign Jai had come up with, a sign that identified them as one of his. He hated to think of them like that, as his. But at the same time, he felt like their lives were his responsibility. When one of them died, he mourned. When one of them cried, he cried with them. When they enjoyed fleeting moments of happiness, he smiled too. Though their eyes were black and they wore the slave mark like all others ensnared by the Emperor's Tatuya, Jai had relieved them of their burden of obedience when he'd first been assigned head of the mine. All it had taken was a simple command to be free. For now they toiled by choice alone, working for the promise of a better future Jai had offered them. If they wanted to leave, to escape, they could. Jai wouldn't stop them. The other masters would, however, and the runaway slave would likely be killed. Some chose to leave and paid the price. Most chose to stay. For now, at least. Although Jai had been tempted on many occasions to teach his people Fen Lu, he had yet to do so. Training in the defense arts would take many years, and he hoped to escape with them long before that. It is my destiny, he thought now. It has to be. So, instead, he conditioned them for whatever was to come next. Before mining in the morning, the people would run laps around the cavern. After mining, they would do more laps. None were exempted, save for those who were with child, too young or too old to walk. My people are strong, he thought. One day that strength will save them. His thoughts were chased away when a small boy, as thin as a reed, ran up to him. Though he was full Terran, his skin red and his hair coppery, he'd never seen Terragon, the continent south of the Four Kingdoms across the Burning Sea. No, he was a second-generation slave, his parents captured and forced into bondage years earlier. The boy moved with a limp, the result of being hit by a falling rock weeks ago. The injury lingered, refusing to heal.
"Jai," the boy said, "you're here."
Jai hugged him and tousled his straw-like hair, painted orange in the torchlight. His hair was long, well past his shoulders. As soon as Jai had given the people their freedom of choice, they reverted back to their country's customs of long hair for males and short for females. The boy was wearing the typical garb of slaves, a thin shirt and pants cut from sackcloth. Unfortunately, it was all they had. "I'm back," Jai said. "How is Emperor Jig, the mightiest miner in all of Fane's?" Jig giggled, and Jai could almost imagine this was a normal boy, if not for his shadowy eyes and the chain marking circling the red skin of his neck.
"Mother says I can't work the mines until my leg heals."
"Your mother is a wise woman."
"I guess,"
Jig said, sounding unconvinced.
"What news from Fainir?"
Jai grinned. He knew the boy was trying to sound like a man, mimicking a standard question he'd heard one of the adults ask. "I saw a Paizan," Jai said.
"You did?"
Jig bounced on his toes. He was always eager to hear stories of the outside world. The boy was born in Garadia and had never seen true sunlight, other than a few errant beams that wafted through cracks in the rocks above.
"What did it do?"
"Slept, mostly. And stuck out its tongue."
"Oh."
Jig sounded disappointed. "Would you rather it had bitten me?" Jai raised his eyebrows.
"No,"
the boy said.
"But maybe if you fought it and chopped off its head, that would make a good story."
"Next time," Jai promised with a wink. "Have you had supper?" Jig went quiet, staring at his feet, which were bare and dirty. "Jig," Jai said sternly.
"The bread tastes funny,"
the boy said. He was never going to heal if he didn't eat, Jai knew. "We'll eat together," he said. The boy kicked a stone.
"Do I have to?"
"Yes."
"Is it a command?"
Jai hated that this innocent boy's entire life boiled down to that one question. It seemed all of Fane's was built upon a foundation formed of that one word, command. Just like his own life, his own birthright. His father's words echoed through his memory. "I never commanded her. Not like that." Jai shook his head, letting the words vanish. "No," he said. "I will not tell you what to do. But you should listen to your mother. She knows best." Jig grabbed Jai's hand and pulled him off to the side, to an area somewhat enclosed by a series of large boulders. There, what was left of Jig's family sat cross-legged, huddled around a flat rock set with food. His mother, Morella, his elder sister, Viola. There were two empty spots, one for Jig and one for his father, who had died in a cave-in a year earlier.
"Jai Jaru,"
Morella said. Though Jai refused to let any of them call him Master, Jig's mother found it difficult to refer to him by first name only.
"Please, sit. Join us."
"Thank you," Jai said.
"You can have father's seat,"
Jig said. "No," Morella snapped. Her tone softened.
"I mean, please, we will squeeze in another place for you." "Yes, beside me,"
Viola said. offering a wide smile. Though she was only 11, the girl was always trying to hold Jai's hand or hug him. There was no doubt in his mind that she was smitten. The thought made him feel awful inside.
"Of course," Jai said.
He wouldn't have felt comfortable sitting in the place of her husband anyway. He slid to the ground between Jig and Viola. The latter immediately latched onto him, holding his arm.
"Jig won't eat his bread," Morella said.
"So I heard," Jai said, breaking off a piece. It was too hard, and beginning to smell of mould. Hence the funny taste the boy had complained about. Still, it was all they had, the leftovers from the city. He took a large bite, chewing with his mouth open, smacking his lips.
"Mmm, it tastes of almond butter and sifted flour."
In truth, it tasted sour and earthy.
"Almonds," the boy said, raising his eyebrows. "I've never tasted those."
He took his own piece of bread and bit in. As Jig munched on the bread, wrinkling his nose and commenting on all the strange tastes he was experiencing, his mother offered a nod of thanks in Jai's direction. Jai returned her nod, his thoughts drifting to the situation at hand. In the morn, he would be forced to announce the Emperor's decree about increasing diamond output. The morale of his people already sat on a knife's edge, and he was afraid this news would push them into despair. More and more, Jai felt like his life was a fast-moving river, carrying him along at its will and whim, occasionally dashing him against rocks and fallen timber. Every move forward seemed to bring him closer to a precipice, where an eternal waterfall would drop him down, down, down. No. No. He wouldn't think that way. There had to be a solution, a way to save all of them, or at least give them a chance. Yes. It was known that the range of the Emperor's control over his slaves only extended to a limited distance. That was one of the many reasons why his slave army hadn't yet invaded Calypso and won the civil war. Doing so would mean the Emperor would have to travel with the army, and he wasn't willing to expose himself to the risk. Not yet, anyway, though it was only a matter of time. "If I can only get them out of range," Jai thought, "maybe we'll have a chance. But how far would they have to go? And how would he ensure that the Emperor didn't catch wind of their plot until they were far enough away?" These were the questions Jai was trying to answer as he finished his humble meal and lay down to sleep in the midst of his people, Jig's arm across his chest on one side and Viola's on the other. He still hadn't come up with a solution when he heard the first cries rise up, echoing down the tunnels from the mine's entrance. They were cries of battle. 7. The Southern Empire, Calip. The Beggar. After countless hours spent in darkness, the light was as bright as staring directly into the sun. The beggar raised a hand to shield his eyes, but the light had already been lowered, casting a yawning yellow sheen across the sandstone floor. He couldn't see who was there, his vision dancing with spots. A shadow person.
"I'm still alive,"
the beggar tried to say.
"Why?"
But nothing came out but a groan, his mouth as dry as dust, his lips as cracked as a sunburnt desert floor.
"You are the bearer of the plague," a voice said. "The one they call Demon Child?"
"No, please. I am the beggar, not a demon. Not a water,"
was all he managed to croak out.
"An answer first, then water."
The bearer of the lantern angled the light backwards, and he saw who it was. The Empress. Sun Sands. This close up she was even more spectacular than from afar, her eyes like grey silk, her blonde locks waves of crashing sunlight. She wore a light green dress, criss-crossing strands of material that exposed slits of diagonal skin, night dark in the manner typical of Calypsians.
"An answer,"
the beggar repeated in his head.
"What was the question again?"
His mind was fuzzy, shriveled, like a piece of fruit left too long in the sun.
"Yes, that is it. The plague." "Yes, I am the plague. The plague is me."
His voice was scratchy, but at least it was working again. He moved to throw back his hood and reveal himself, but his hand caught only empty air. His fingers searched his body for his cloak, but found only skin as pale as moonlight, dancing with orange light from the lantern. At some point they'd stripped him, left him lying naked in the dark.
"My skin," he said, clambering back, away from the Empress. "Stay away from my skin."
He didn't want to hurt anyone else, especially not a woman as beautiful and strong as the Empress. Despite his warnings, the Empress approached. She handed him a cup of water.
"Please, place it on the ground," he said.
"As you wish." She did, and as soon as she'd drawn back, his hand darted out like a striking cobra and yanked it back, spilling half of it in his haste to drink.
"Ah,"
he moaned, the flames in his throat doused. He licked his lips.
"Thank you. Now, you have to kill me."
"The tattoo on your neck, the three broken circles, it gives you your power?"
"Why is she asking me such things?" he wondered. "Why is she delaying my fate? I have no power, only a curse."
"And it turns your eyes as red as hot metal. Curious. Does your skin burn in the sun?"
"Yes," he blurted out, without thinking.
"Can you control whom you infect with the plague?"
"What? Please, just—"
"I'm not going to kill you."
"Why not?"
"You're like my daughter, Fire. Special. Our people believe that all those, like you, have a purpose. I would not waste someone like you. Not when you could be the key to the civil war plaguing the South."
She laughed lightly at her own wit.
"I am no one. I am the beggar. I have killed hundreds. No, thousands. I deserve to die. I want to die."
"I am the Empress of Calip, and I decide your fate. Now that we have you, we can control you. Plague Island is destroyed, and we were forced to exterminate the two-headed dragons that once guarded it. The beasts were old and half-mad anyway, so I won't fault you for that. But now we fear to dump the infected in the ocean, as it might contaminate the great waters. But as long as we have you, the plague can be sent far away from Calip, to Fanes, to my divorced husband, the slave master, may he rot in the underworld."
The beggar couldn't stop the dam from bursting any longer. He covered his head with his hands and wept. The Empress said nothing while he cried, and eventually he stopped. He looked up through blurred vision.
"I don't want to hurt anyone. Please don't make me."
"Dear boy," she said, "you can do great things, things that matter. All you have to do is reach out and touch those I command you to. Pledge yourself to me, and I will help you. I will give you sturdy clothes, thick gloves, a face mask, everything you need to ensure you only come into contact with those you're meant to. How does that sound?"
He wasn't certain exactly, but it didn't sound as awful as he thought it would. Maybe he could still live, in the service of this powerful woman, the Dragon of the South, as she was known. He opened his mouth to answer, but then closed it when the air shimmered on the edge of his vision, almost like a mirage taking shape in the desert. When he turned his head, he was shocked to find a boy, his scalp as bald as the day he was born, a round mark shining brightly. His eyes burned like fires, a stark contradiction to his snow-white skin and the dark clothing he wore, a cloak, gloves, and boots.
"What in the name of the gods are you?"
Sun Sand said. The light wobbled as she backed away a step. For the first time since she'd arrived, the beggar thought he could detect fear in her voice.
"I am Bane, and you are marked for death," he said.
Then, with a speed and strength that defied explanation, the boy grabbed the beggar under the arms and launched him at the Empress. He flailed in midair, trying to change his trajectory, but his momentum was too great. His naked body crashed into her, and he immediately felt the buzz of skin on skin in multiple places. She screamed. scrubbing at her arms and legs with her hands as she rolled away. But it was too late. Once touched, it was always too late. Horrified, the beggar watched as red pustules rose to the surface of her skin, spreading like a wildfire raging out of control.
"No,"
she whispered under her breath.
"Oh, gods, no."
She stood, stepping on the edge of her dress in her haste, the fabric ripping under her trod. Then she turned and ran. He watched her go, releasing a whimper of regret, tears already bubbling from the corners of his eyes. She stopped. She turned. Reaching within the folds of her dress, the Empress of Calip extracted a knife. The expression she wore was calm, almost too calm.
"I must protect my daughters," she said.
And then she raised the knife, the point aiming back toward her chest. The beggar looked away, not wanting to watch. But he could not stopper his ears from the squelch of broken flesh and the muffled thump of her body hitting the floor. "She was going to use you to make war," the boy said, taking a step closer. The one who called himself Bane. He'd heard the rumors, everyone had, of the marked boy wreaking havoc on the rulers of the north and west and east. The king's Bane. And now he was here, in the south. And he'd killed again.
"No, it wasn't him. It was me. I killed her. Me, me. Me, me, me. Oi!"
The boy grabbed him by the chin with his gloved hand and steered his gaze around until their eyes met. The flames had gone out, though the mark on his head was shining even brighter. Half of it seemed to be filled with blood.
"We are alike, you and I. We are the same. Together we can bring peace to the Four Kingdoms. That woman who called herself Empress, she wanted more war, not less. I just want the fighting to stop. I want an end to all the death."
The beggar didn't know what to think, what to say. As much as he didn't want to believe this boy, this killer, he knew he was right. They were the same.
"You don't have to decide now,"
the boy said, slipping off his cloak and wrapping it around the beggar's shoulders.
"Think about it. For now, come with me."
The world spun, twisting with spirals of grey and black and red, and then he lost consciousness. 8. The Southern Empire, Calip. Raven Sands. Raven Sands couldn't believe her martyr was dead.
"The Empress is dead," she thought,
still trying to make sense of the senseless. Thankfully, it wasn't Whisper who'd found her body 2 days earlier. It was Fire, accompanied by the current Shiva or Keeper of Order. In Fire's usual brash way, she'd acted without fear, without hesitation, flinging a flaming blade at her own mother's plague-riddled corpse, burning it to ash and ensuring the disease could not spread. Ordinary fire wasn't enough to eradicate the plague, but Fire's flames were far from ordinary. It had been eerily similar to how their grandmother, Empress Risa Sands, named after the city of the Rising Sun, had died. The man known as the Beggar had vanished after the murder, seemingly into thin air, for none of the guards had seen him escape. Raven was dimly aware that the second daughter, Fire, was speaking, but she couldn't seem to make out the words.
"Oh, gods, what are we going to do?"
Her martyr's voice answered as clearly as if she was sitting directly beside her, having a conversation.
"You will do what the Sands have always done. Fight."
Her sister's words clarified, took shape, and she caught the end of them. "I'm asking is, will you, the first daughter of Calip, make a claim for the Empire, dear sister?" Fire was staring at her, her head cocked to the side. She was doing that thing again, the thing Raven hated, where she made tendrils of flames crackle around her face. Her sister might be an arrogant urchin, but she was also intelligent beyond her years. Since they were little girls, the second daughter had coveted their mother's position as empress. Now she was using her tattooia as a show of power, which was the only thing the Calypsians seemed to respect these days. Well, Raven might not bear a mark of power, but she could be powerful too in her own way, and she would not allow her sister to swoop in and steal the seat of the Empire out from under her. She glanced at her youngest sister, Whisper, who was staring at her feet, her eyes red from crying. Raven stood, her dark eyes swooping across the hundreds of Guanero in attendance, before boring into her sister's. "I am," she said, "and all those who oppose me will find themselves lacking." Fire smirked. She'd always loved a good challenge. "I, too, as the second daughter, will make a claim." She turned purposefully toward Whisper, her mouth opening to speak again. She paused, and Raven saw the brief hesitation. For all her sister's faults, Raven knew Fire loved their sister deeply, protectively. Seeing Whisper in pain was clearly affecting Fire. However, she recovered quickly. "Whisper, as the third daughter of Calip, will you be making a claim for the Empire?" Whisper looked up, blinking rapidly. She'd only recently passed her 14th name day. Had the Empress died a fortnight earlier, she wouldn't have had a claim at all.
"What? No. I will make no claim."
Raven was proud of her youngest sister for faltering only briefly. "Then it is settled. The rule of the Empire shall be mine or Raven's."
"Shiva, Shiva,"
Raven said loudly, cutting her sister off.
"Prepare the arena."
Fire glowered at her, clearly annoyed that she'd stolen her thunder. Raven ignored her, turning on her heel and meeting Whisper across the dais.
"Are you all right?" Raven asked.
She longed to slide her arm around her sister's back to embrace her, but she couldn't, not in front of the Guanero. Sans women were strong and unemotional. They led with strength and loyalty and respect. And, most of all, they grieved in private. Whisper shook her head, saying nothing. Fire caught up to them as they exited into the palace courtyard in the back. The massive three-sided pyramids, for which Calypso was known, stretched for the sky on each side, casting long triangular shadows across the land, intersecting in the center, where the unburning tree stood, its branches eternally aflame. It was said that the moment Fire came screaming into the world, the sacred tree caught fire and could not be extinguished, whether by water or blankets or otherwise. Though the tree was sheathed in flames, it did not burn. As the sisters marched across the courtyard, several servants slipped in behind them, carrying Whisper's long, pale pink silk dress so it wouldn't drag in the dust. Raven's garb was far more practical, a short leather skirt with matching tunic, fitted with a dozen loops and clasps used to carry all manner of weaponry, her long whips, several knives, three vials of poison, and a black ivory whistle constructed of the bones of a guanic, which was used to summon and command the dragons. Fire, in her usual pretentious manner, wore a red dress set with hundreds of guanic scales, making it shimmer in the sun like fire. Almost subconsciously, she summoned flames that began to lick at her heels as she walked.
"Is this really what you want, dear sister?" Fire said. "You know I can lead. Marta always said I was special because of my tattooia."
Raven's sister never missed an opportunity to remind her siblings of her mark, as if they could ever forget about it.
"I do not doubt your ability or your leadership, but I fear you would lead Calypso into a war we cannot win."
Raven had harbored doubts about their mother's plan to use the plague-bearer against their enemies, while Fire had been in full agreement. In the end, Raven wished she'd been wrong.
"We are already at war," Fire snapped. "And you would allow our dearest father to control the south?" "No. But I would be patient and wait for the dragons to mature."
The dragons were a major point of contention amongst the sisters. While Raven was determined to give them more time and training, Fire would fly off into battle with them at this very moment if she could. Whisper, on the other hand, was content to keep them as valuable pets. Fire huffed in frustration, and Fire rolled down her neck.
"Oh, gods, not this again! If it were up to you, Fata will have tripled the size of his slave army before we attack."
It was common knowledge that Vinhosa had begun a breeding strategy for his slave army years earlier. Every 2 years or so, a new batch was ready for battle. Each batch was comprised of 5,000 expertly trained and completely controllable slave warriors.
Slaves are no match for dragons.
Fire went silent, and Raven wished she hadn't spoken. At least there was one thing they were in agreement about. Killing the innocent slaves controlled by their father was a necessary evil both of them wished they didn't have to do. When they reached their personal residence within the palace, Fire said, "May the gods be with you," and stuck out her hand.
"And with you," Raven said,
clasping her hand and sliding her fingers to her sister's wrist. She recoiled sharply when Fire's skin heated up rapidly, burning her. Fire laughed, and hustled into her rooms before Raven could retaliate. Whisper tried to smile, but failed miserably.
"Perhaps you should just let her have the Empire. I've never seen her so determined."
"I will die before I submit to her," Raven muttered, sucking on her burned fingers.
"Don't say that."
The look on her sister's face made Raven's anger melt away.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean... I miss her too."
Raven tugged Whisper gently into her rooms, letting the wall of tied-together guanic bones dangling from the entrance fall back into place behind them, clanking softly in the breeze. Whisper fell into her arms, sobbing into her chest. Raven's leather tunic was soon slick with tears.
"Oh, sister," she said, "I am here always. I miss her too much. Like rain in the desert,"
Whisper said, craning her head back to look into Raven's eyes. Her sister had always been an emotional sort, crying at the loss of one of the dragon brood, collecting sunflowers in the garden, decorating her sister's rooms. But now, this time, Raven thought she understood exactly what her sister was feeling. It was like a gaping hole had opened in her chest, filling with sand where her heart should be. It was so painful, it almost doubled her over, and it took all her strength, the strength given to her by both her parents, to remain upright. She had to be strong for her youngest sister, for the Empire, and she would.
"Come," Raven said. "I will draw you a cool bath. It will help."
While Whisper sat on the edge of her bed, Raven dried the tears from her sister's sun-kissed cheeks, smoothed her chestnut hair back behind her delicate ears, and began to prepare her bath. She didn't request help from the palace servants. Some things you had to do on your own. On the morrow she would enter the arena to face her own sister in a battle for the future. But tonight she would think of nothing but the past. Hours later, after Whisper was bathed and dressed in nightclothes, and the sun had dipped so far beneath the horizon that the pyramids became shadowy, spiked mountains, Fire slipped into the room without a word. The three sisters huddled under the covers and spoke of memories of the woman who raised them, trained them, and never failed to tell them what they were worth. They laughed and cried and remembered everything there was to remember. And then they slept all in a row until morning came upon the city of the rising sun.
9. The Southern Empire fanes. Jai Jaru. With a hissed warning to Jig and Viola to remain behind with their mother, Jai sprinted for the tunnel entrance. He hurdled several groggy miners who were sitting up and rubbing their eyes, dashed past a woman carrying two babes in her arms, and pushed between several of the larger miners, who had made their way to the front of the cavern, presumably to defend the others if necessary. The clank of metal on metal echoed down the tunnel, punctuated by cries of determination and pain. It was hard to tell one from the other. "The mine is under attack," Jai realized. "But by whom?" "The Emperor," was the first thought that struck him. Jai's methods had been determined to be too radical, too wild, regardless of the results. He and his mine masters would be struck down and replaced, as quickly and easily as ants in an anthill. Falcon Hosa would get his wish, and all Jai's work to get to this position would be for naught. Worse, the slaves would be punished for his sins, he knew. "Stay here," he commanded the cavern full of people, and he knew they would obey because they had to. "Unless..." He shook his head as he raced down the tunnel, his shadow growing and shrinking as he passed each torch mounted to the wall. He emerged from the tunnel into chaos. Shadowy shapes moved all around him. A wash of green moonlight spilled through the mine entrance, glancing off the silver edges of weapons, swords and whip barbs and knives, flashing like fireflies in the dark. It was hard to tell friend from foe, but then thump, 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 thump. Bodies fell almost in unison, hitting the ground with a vicious finality. How many? Half a dozen. And on which side? Beside him, Jai only had a dozen mine masters in his employ. "Master Jiru," an unfamiliar voice said, stepping forward from the gloom, carrying a torch. It was a woman's voice, and there were no women masters, a requirement laid down by Emperor Hoza himself. Jai shielded his eyes from the light, squinting, trying to see the torchbearer. His body instinctively fell into Fen Lu defense position, his knees bent, parallel to each other, his hips level, his back straight. His arms ready to block an attack if one came. "Who are you?" "For you. The Angel of Death. The Reaper. The End." Jai had no weapon. He'd never even carried a whip the way the other masters did, because he was more likely to turn it on the masters than the slaves. He was his own weapon. "You are a master of Fen Lu," the woman said, sounding surprised. He nodded. "And Fen Ru?" Though true, it was a blatant attempt to give her pause before she attacked. "An unusual combination. And yet you settle into the defense position first." "It was the first I learned. My preference." He took a step back, maintaining his stance, but she'd already cut the distance between them by half. More shadows crowded around her, shoulder to shoulder, blades emerging from the gloom like spikes from an enormous mace. The women wore tan, form-fitting trousers and tunics, their belts teeming with weapons. He realized something. "They dispatched my mine masters, all of whom were masters of Fen Ru. These women must fight like wildcats." "Please," Jai said, but it was not a plea for his own life. "Don't hurt the people. Give them a chance to escape." "Escape?" The word seemed to confuse the woman so much that her hand danced aside for a moment, the light stretching its fingers across her face. Jai sucked in a breath. Her skin was covered in black markings. They were tears. "You are the Black Tears," Jai said, remembering the tales of what they'd done to the other two mines, how they'd helped the slaves escape. And now they were attacking Garadia, the Emperor's most prized possession. Jai shook his head, unable to keep a thin smile from creasing his face. The brazenness of their attack was inspiring. He straightened up, falling out of stance. "And you are dead, master." She handed the torch to another woman, who was clearly Terran, her red face also dotted with night-dark tears, and strode forward, raising her sword. Jai didn't want to die, but at least he would go, knowing his people had a chance. Noises behind him made him half-turn. A small form emerged from the tunnel, racing toward him. Jig hugged him around the leg, squeezing hard. His eyes were huge as he stared at the woman with her blade held high.
"Don't hurt him!"
the boy shrieked. More forms moved forward, slipping around him like river water around a rock. Viola, Marella, other miners too. Gorin the Dreadnoughter, and Hans and Petrella, and Nance and Hominy, and dozens of others. Jai didn't know how it was possible. They'd come to help him, despite the fact that he'd given them a direct order not to. Perhaps my prior command giving them free will took precedence, he thought. He was no student of the complexities of slave command, since he rarely used the power bestowed upon him by the Emperor. Past them, Jai could barely make out the woman's surprised expression as she lowered her sword. "You would protect your master, the one who has enslaved you?" she asked, her voice echoing in the mine atrium.
"The Emperor enslaved us, not Jai Jiru. And yes, we would protect him to the death," one of the men answered.
A man named Karp, whom Jai had broken bread with on numerous occasions. A man untrained in combat, and yet willing to fight for him, die for him.
"Has he commanded you to do this?"
The woman was frowning now. Clearly in her past mine attacks, she'd never had a situation where the slaves defended one of the masters.
"No,"
a woman said. Sharma. She was big with child, her first.
Her husband was a burly fellow named Burnis, whose long braid nearly reached his feet. They were hoping for a girl. As more and more of the people chimed in, Jai was surprised by how many of them he knew personally, how many he'd shared a story with, how many he'd eaten with, laughed with. He wanted to save them, but instead they were protecting him. It didn't seem fair. "How is this possible?" the woman said. Jai said to Jig, "It's fine now. Thank you," and detached the boy's fingers and feet from him, one at a time. He stepped forward, his people parting for him as he made his way toward the front. The woman had regathered her torch and was shining her light across the people. She had jet-black hair braided in back, smooth brown skin and fierce, narrow green eyes that sparkled as if studded with emeralds. Her eyes gave her away as a Phoenician. She wore a tan leather vest, leaving her shoulders and arms bare. "They are not injured," she commented. "No whip marks, no bruises, no scars. I don't understand." Jai scanned the women in front of him. They were as different from each other as the stars in the sky. While the leader was clearly of Phoenician descent, as was one of the others, two of them were red-skinned Terrans and two were dreadnoughters, their broad, flat foreheads grey and rough. However, despite their differences, they all bore black tears beneath their eyes, but some had more than others, and none more than their leader, the woman in front. "The number of people they have killed," Jai remembered, at least according to the whisperings in the city. There were only six of them, a fact that awed him. Six women had taken a mine defended by twice that many masters. Then again, each of them wore the face of a warrior, with the lean, strong bodies to match. "I can explain," Jai said. "This mine is run by the people, not the masters."
"You mean the slaves?"
Jai shook his head.
"To the Emperor they might be slaves, but to me they are my friends, my family, my people."
The woman's narrow eyes narrowed further.
"You commanded them to be free."
"But the Emperor," Jai said,
"what is your name?"
"Anguish, sorrow, regret, destiny. I have many names, and all of them are laced with sadness for the souls I've lost."
"Gods!" Her words seemed to slash open a wound in Jai's gut. He was intimately acquainted with those names. They were his past, they were his present, and, he knew, they were his future. She continued,
"But the name given to me at birth was Sonika Vade."
"Sonika," Jai said, trying it out. By his estimation, the name was fit for a warrior, and suited her well.
"I am Jai Jaru. Please do not call me master, whether out of mockery or spite, because I loathe the title as much as you. Unfortunately, I could not command these people to be free, as you have suggested. The Emperor's influence roams far, and yes, reaches well past Garadia. But I have given them free will within the confines of this mine, and so long as they meet their quotas, the Emperor will not intercede."
"The Emperor is a Paizan,"
Sonika hissed, sounding much like a snake herself. "I cannot disagree with you," Jai said. "But that doesn't mean we can ignore his power."
"Damn his power and his quotas into the void!"
Though the anger was clear in her voice, Jai could sense the frustration behind it. This was a woman trying to carry out a rebellion against an enemy who was almost untouchable because of his tattooia. "Where are the other mine masters?" Jai asked, though he'd already guessed their fate. Her lips curled into a sneer.
"Dead."
"How?"
"They were all masters of Fen Ru. We are masters of a higher art."
"Fen Lu?"
She laughed.
"Foolish man. Fen Sir is the highest of the martial arts, though none but the women seem to realize it."
Confusion roiled through him. Fen Sir was a beautiful art form, but he'd never seen it used for violence. He could hardly comprehend it.
"You killed my men with a dance?"
"Yes. Would you mourn them?"
Jai shook his head.
"No. He wouldn't mourn his lost masters. Yes, they had allowed him to manage the mine in his own way, but it wasn't out of kindness. No, it was because he gave them an easy life of luxury.
They were as guilty as the Emperor himself. But I have to count them, to make certain none escaped to report back to the Emperor.
Sonika blinked, as if surprised by his response, but then stepped aside to allow him to pass.
Jai turned back to the mine workers. He felt a flutter in his chest, like a bird was trapped within his ribcage. He knew this was it. His one opportunity. Another would not come easily. My destiny.
Return to the cavern. Gather your things. Capture as much water from the stream as possible. Bring all the food we have. We are leaving.
The people didn't move, their eyes set on him, their lips falling open a crack. Blinking, blinking, not understanding. Not truly.
When someone has been kept in the dark for so long, how can you convince them to step into the light?
Jai wondered. He raised his hand in the air, forming it into the three-fingered salute.
You will never mine another diamond again, he shouted.
Burnus clapped his hands together.
Now, that's a tempting proposal. Come on, lads. Come on, lasses. Tonight we leave this filthy void hole forever.
An almost electric energy seemed to hum through the crowd as they passed the message to turn around to the hundreds still amassed in the tunnel behind them. Jai placed a hand on Burnus's shoulder.
Thank you, old friend. Will you please gather a dozen others and raid the master's quarters? There will be food and water there, too. Take everything you can carry, and then come back for more. Be quick. We only have a limited window for escape.
Aye, I will.
The thick-set man strode off, grabbing other men and women by the arms and relaying the message. Satisfied that his people would rise to the task of preparing for departure, Jai turned back to the Black Tears, who were watching him intently. He nodded to Sonika, and after a moment's pause, she nodded back. He strode past her, stooping to inspect the first body. Master Gabon, his dark black moustache unmistakable, drooping well past his lips. He'd been an easy sell a few years earlier. All he cared about was his own well-being, and the promise of an easy lifestyle had been enough to sway him to Jai's plan. Jai checked for a heartbeat. There was none.
One,
Jai said in his head. One by one, he checked the others. By the time he was finished, only one was missing, but that didn't concern him. It was Master Axa, who had betrayed Jai to the Emperor and been slave-marked as a result. By now he would be more than halfway from Fania to Garadia, stumbling in the dark, stubbing his bare toes on rocks and cacti. With luck, he'd be bitten by a scorpion and die under the stars, his body eventually picked clean like the carrion he was. Following behind Jai, the Black Tears were removing each body, carrying them to the master's quarters and away from the mine entrance.
"That's all of them," Jai announced. "Your warriors are thorough."
"Yes, it seems you're the only master left,"
Sonika said. Her hand was on the hilt of her sword.
"And you have no one left to protect you."
Jai's heart thudded faster in his chest.
"Kill me if you must," he said. "So long as you protect my people, and do not call me master."
Sonika drew her sword, stepped forward, turning the blade slowly to let it catch the emerald moonlight, said,
"Your words ring true, but I want you to swear with your blood."
"I will."
Jai held out his hand, palm up. With an expert jerk of her hand, Sonika sliced her blade across his palm. Jai gritted his teeth, refusing to acknowledge the sting of pain sizzling through his flesh. It was nothing compared to what his miners had been through, the pain they felt every day from their labors. He squeezed his fingers tight against his palm, making a fist, letting several drops of blood drip to the ground.
"I swear I will do no harm to these people. I swear I am no master, but a rebel like you. I swear on my blood that so long as you help my people, I will help you."
The leader of the Black Tears nodded once, and then motioned to one of the other women, who provided a thick cloth, wrapping it around Jai's cut hand several times, before tearing it with her teeth and tying off the end. The Terran woman had short, coppery hair that curled around her chin. Twice she glanced at Jai between long golden lashes before continuing her work, licking her pink lips. As she bandaged him, Jai counted the black tears on her red-skinned cheeks. 17. He wondered how many tears she'd be adding for the men she'd killed tonight.
"Thank you," Jai said when she finished. "What is your name?"
"Shanti," she said.
"Shanti Parthena Lord."
A beautiful name, he thought. He knew Terran names held great meaning. He wondered what hers meant, but it wasn't the time to ask. "I'm Jai Giroux," he said. She laughed slightly.
"I know. You were supposed to be the first to die, but instead we found another in your bed."
With that, she went back to helping her comrades remove the bodies of the masters.
"Does everybody want me dead?" Jai said to himself. Though the question wasn't meant for her, Sonika answered.
"If the Emperor finds out you're alive, then yes, everyone will want you dead. But we will burn the bodies, so it will be harder for them to know whether anyone survived."
"Thank you.
Now show us the diamonds."
"What?
You think a rebellion is cheap? We will need the diamonds as much as the food and water. And they're easy to haul. Have your people squeeze them anywhere they'll fit. In their shoes, in their undergarments, in their mouths if they wish. Bring all the diamonds they can carry."
Jai frowned, although the logic made sense. It just seemed strange to take the diamonds like common thieves. Then again, they were the ones who'd broken their backs to mine the jewels for years. If anything, it was back payment for all their hard work.
"Fine. But today's haul has already been carted to the Emperor's palace."
"Then mine more."
Jai wouldn't ask his people to raise another sledge or pick ever again. He'd never ask them to haul another cart, or risk their lives in another unstable mineshaft.
"No. I'll go myself."
As it turned out, Jai didn't have to ask anyone to descend into the mineshaft with him. He had a wealth of volunteers ready and willing, including two strong dreadnoughters, Gorin and Orin, twin brothers with identical grey features. And though on occasion the mine was stubborn, not tonight. It was as if the gods themselves were a part of their escape. Before dawn arrived, they had hauled three heaping carts of uncut gems, shimmering piles of wealth beyond measure.
"Are there more?" Sonika asked, eyeing the carts.
"This mine will produce for another decade or longer," Jai said. "There are always more. But it will take time, and every second we wait is a risk."
He was exhausted and sore, but now that the people were emerging from the tunnel, strapped with bags laden with food and water, he was anxious to leave.
Sonika said, "Fine. It will have to do."
"Where are the other tears?"
Jai asked, his eyes probing the space for Shanti and the others.
"Preparing a gift for the Emperor," she said, a twinkle in her eyes.
Jai didn't know what that meant, but he didn't take further time to ponder. Instead, he instructed each person emerging from the tunnel to gather some of the diamonds amongst their things and to exit the mine. Many had glittering tears in their eyes, and others wore weary but determined expressions. Dozens turned to hundreds, turned to thousands, but Jai waited for each of them to pass before joining them outside. The last was the eldest woman in the mine, Mother Ko, everyone called her. Her skin was so wrinkled it looked like a sheet of parchment that had been balled up and smoothed out over and over again. Her long, hooked nose had so many broken blood vessels it was like a beacon on her face. But her unnaturally dark eyes were still clear and intelligent. From past discussions with her, Jai knew she was as shrewd a person as there was, and her age alone told him much about what she was made of. She was weighed down with a dozen bags, wrapped around her neck and shoulders, and bulging from her body like camel humps.
"Here, let me take a few of those," Jai offered.
She slapped him away with shaking hands.
"Help someone else," she said. "I'm no cripple."
Yes, she was as tough as a sledge, but also as stubborn as a mule, a sometimes frustrating combination. Jai followed her out, shaking his head. When he emerged into the daylight, he felt another flutter in his chest. They were leaving, at long last. To his ears, his heartbeat sounded much like the gallop of a trio of exuberant horses riding in unison. For the first time in a long time, he felt a true ray of light-giving hope in the darkness.
The sun was rising in the west, lighting the tops of the red cliffs that bordered the sea, and sending plumes of pink and orange across a sky so blue it might have been painted on. Thousands of people stood before him, waiting.